Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. During Sandy, 9,662 New York City street trees were destroyed. The average NYPD response time to a crime in progress is 9 minutes and 6 seconds. And 10023 is the zip code with the highest residential electricity use in the city. Upper West Siders, we should talk. We know these numbers and many, many more thanks to the city's Office of Analytics. The department's work has become central to how the city has been run under Mayor Bloomberg, and the city's chief of analytics joins us now. Michael Flowers is director of analytics for Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Office of Policy and Strategic Planning. His talk at the Guggenheim tonight is part of the museum's Participatory City program. Mike Flowers, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Good morning.
And by way of background a little, if we might, you're a lawyer, not originally a data person, I've read. And I understand that you worked in the green zone in Baghdad, identifying areas of suspected mass graves. So how did you get from there to working for municipal government?
Yes, that's all correct. Happenstance more than anything else. I was a prosecutor up here in Manhattan under Mr. Morgenthau, and for personal reasons, my now wife was living in Washington, and so one of us had to move, and it was me. And I went to a large law firm, and it was not for me, and I guess in a sign of how much it wasn't for me, the day I found out that I had gotten the job to go over to Baghdad, I was kicking my heels in the hallway to leave a $250,000-a-year job to airdrop into a war zone. But and then from there, I got home, and it was one of those, you know, how do you keep them down on the farm when they've seen Paris type things? I couldn't imagine myself back behind a desk doing what I had been doing before, and so I went to the Hill, worked on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations with Senator Levin's staff and Senator Coleman's staff, and you know, we did some really interesting stuff involving analytics in terms of hunting down people and corporations that were abusing the tax code through offshore tax havens in Switzerland and Liechtenstein. And then I got a phone call from a former colleague at the DA's office who was working for the Bloomberg administration and asked me if I was interested in taking what we were doing on the Hill, using analytics to track financial crime up here in New York City, and I jumped at it. And then that proved to be valuable enough that we expanded our outcomes from financial crime to pretty much everything the city does.
And data is addictive, isn't it? I know people who've gone from other fields into data work, too. And when you get into this big data, especially if you can use it in a public service-oriented way, it just kind of gets in your head, and you want to do it and do it and do it. So let's take an example. I read about something that your team looking at ambulances and how to reduce response times. And, you know, that's been an issue in the news recently. There was a frustrating and scary situation at a school in Brooklyn where I think it took 40 minutes for an ambulance to come, and there have been some other things. So can you talk about that, how you use the data to reduce ambulance response times?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of things. So, you know, there are people that spend decades trying to look at how to get better at the delivery of emergency services. And what you end up doing, what had traditionally been done, is figuring out how to get from point A to point B more quickly without the ability really to kind of take the different data elements that are involved the moment the last one is hit on your 911 call to the routing of that call to somebody to send an ambulance to you in the first place. So what the data elements end up becoming is not so much, you know, the locations of things as it is how the transaction could be streamlined. And the only way you can do that, in all honesty, is taking these different data elements together, making them sing, so that you can then say, oh, I guess maybe we need to swap up our script, or we need to do a better job on our mapping, or, you know, when we hear a location here, what they really mean is over here. And then from there, you can, you know, basically manage to the data, as Deputy Mayor Holloway puts it.
The New York Times published some stats from your office earlier this year, like those numbers I mentioned in the introduction. I've read that the equivalent of 143 million printed pages of raw information about the city passes through your office every day. What is your office focused on the most out of all that information? What are the biggest areas of interest or your use of data during your time with the mayor?
So we have, I'd say, about three areas that we are mostly concerned with. One of those is day-to-day operations, which is, you know, ranging from building inspections to cigarette inspections to, you know, emergency response, trash pickup, things like that. The second is economic development, so, you know, how to streamline and incentivize the opening of new businesses in the city and how to assist those people to get open more quickly. And then lastly, you know, disaster response and sustainability. And, you know, that last one is really why I would say the concept has taken off so aggressively. It had a lot to do with when Hurricane Sandy hit and we had an eighth of the city underwater and another eighth without power. And, you know, we have this massive sets of armies of city workers out there actively trying to get the city back on its feet. There was really the only way to really coordinate all that is to take all of their information and synthesize it, and then that gives us a sense of what's going on out there.
And there's criticism of how data is used, too, including leveled at the Bloomberg administration. Comstat, as much as that's been heralded with respect to keeping track of crime and using it to fight crime, the imperfect numbers from the NYPD, and on the use of metrics in education, where better test scores, critics say, don't necessarily mean more well-educated kids. They could mean easier tests, as we've seen in recent years. So those are measurement problems. How do you and your team address the limits of data?
I mean, those are really good points, and I think the danger is to fetishize the data to a certain degree, and I think that happens a lot. People just hear data, 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 and that's all they think about. The reality is there is a humanity behind that data, and that humanity is not just, you know, the city resources, the city employees that are going out and delivering these services to New Yorkers, but the New Yorkers themselves and where they live. And I think if you don't take into account both of those while you're interpreting what you're looking at and then sending your resource accordingly, then you're going to run into problems.
Do you use Comstat per se and consider it a reliable source of data on crime?
Well, we don't necessarily. So NYPD has an extremely robust analytics capacity internally. And so what we end up doing is leveraging what NYPD knows to do other things. Where we do work with NYPD is primarily, like I said, having to do with 911 response optimization. So, you know, that said, we also know where every 911 call is occurring in the city, and those are, you know, crime, fire, and ambulance services. And so, you know, I won't necessarily say that I use reported data from agencies, regardless whether it's NYPD or the Department of Finance or whomever, the kind of things you see, like, you know, your key performance indicators, I guess. What we end up doing is using the back end of it, because, frankly, what I most care about is location data.
And does 911 necessarily track where the most crimes are taking place? Maybe 911 is a more accurate indicator than 311. I've heard that the neighborhood with the highest number of 311 calls isn't necessarily the neighborhood with the biggest problem. The neighborhood that complains the most about rat sightings, for example, isn't necessarily the neighborhood with the most rats. So
right.
Is that true, and is it different for crime?
I think that's absolutely correct, and it is different for crime. I think, and a lot of it probably has to, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, the state of the caller and the event about which they're calling. 911 services do reflect, you know, where the incidents, the emergency incidents are happening, whereas 311, a 311 call may not necessarily, you know, be wrong in the sense that it's not a condition, you know, the condition that the person is complaining of is false, so much as it's probably not, it's not as clearly an indication of urgency. And by that, an example I would give, right, would be, you know, if there's a street light out and somebody looks up and sees the light out, then and then they call 311 and say the light's out, about 99 times out of 100, that light is actually out when the Department of Transportation shows up to change the light. But when you're talking about things that are really actually kind of technocratic at the end of the day, like a building code violation, right? These are engineers, but, you know, structural engineers that write these codes, and those codes are written for safety purposes, and somebody may misinterpret a condition to say, oh, well, that's clearly something that should go to the Department of Buildings, when in fact it's not. So, you know, in order to get around that problem, we have to start, and what we've started doing is basically risk assessing the 311 calls, the way that the 911 calls are triaged. You know, when you call 911, the operator is going to ask, what's your emergency and where are you, right? And then the triage is done almost right there by the operator.
Right.
On 311, there's a script triage, but once it falls into a certain agency bucket, then it goes into the agency system, and then they take it in, you know, basically on a simple queue. Whereas what we're doing now is saying, okay, just because you called before somebody over in Brownsville, mm-hmm. because of what we know about that condition, that location in Brownsville, we're going to go to Brownsville first.
My guest is Michael Flowers. He's Director of Analytics for Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Office of Policy and Strategic Planning. He's the data guy. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. We could take a couple of calls from Mike Flowers if anybody has any data questions, data and public policy questions. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We're not afraid of math on this show, and we're also not afraid of what's good for the city. So 212-433-9692. There was news from your office that I saw recently. You and some of your IT colleagues announced that you'll be releasing more data sets to the public, and your goal is to publish all public data on a data portal by the year 2018. I guess it takes a while. And I saw that there was a city council hearing yesterday about a new law that would require more information about a crime and crash data map, I guess it's known as. And the criticism of the city was that agencies release data that's incomplete or they don't release the data at all. So talk about the openness with this data, because some of the real data geeks, the people who are so enthusiastic about this, openness of the data is so central to the thinking.
Absolutely. And, you know, we kind of rely on that community in many ways to tell us where we're wrong. It doesn't mean we always listen with the alacrity with which I think they would want us to listen, but we take their suggestions very seriously. The whole concept of the open data portal really kind of has three legs to it. One is, you know, transparency out to the public, which is really more of a qualitative function. Ironically, more than anything else, which is to say, this is your government, this is what we do, these are the nuts and bolts of the services we deliver to New Yorkers on a day-to-day basis. Another leg of it is we would like very much for people to use this data to, you know, build our economy. We have a burgeoning technology sector, and it is of critical importance to us that that sector continue to grow, and to the extent they can rely on New York City data to help them do that and hire people and pay taxes. To help us pay for police, policemen and firemen and teachers, we really want to encourage that. And then finally, what it's ended up doing is making us better inside as a government. So, you know, my first project, the one that actually got us off the ground, I didn't go to other agencies and ask them for data, which is the usual problem I think people run into when you're inside the government. I think people make this kind of assumption that the government is some kind of monolithic entity, and from the outside I understand why they would think that, but it's really not the case at all. It's more like a cat herding exercise. And so by putting this data out on a portal, then, for example, the Department of Health doesn't need to call the Department of Buildings and ask for data. Now they can just go to the open data portal and get it. And so that actually serves a government efficiency element.
Rachel in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Mike Flowers. Hello, Rachel.
As a researcher, I listened recently to a This American Life segment that talked about the problems with CompStat in the 81st precinct. It was a story that was originally reported by the Village Voice, in which essentially the push of quantitative data and data collecting led to this perhaps unpredictable human error that led to incredible abuses in the case of the civil liberties of people living in Washington Heights. And my question is, given that this administration has had so much emphasis on quantitative data analysis, how do you think you could better use qualitative markers, and not what you were just mentioning in terms of a sort of description of services, but really contextualizing how what those numbers mean, whatever, whether you're talking about school numbers and testing or you're talking about mapping. You said you were very concerned about mapping where offenses happen, to sort of better understand and design responses that could lessen the chance of real abuses, whether it's in the schools or the streets or whatever.
I mean, I think those are, you know, legitimate concerns you're raising. I can't speak to what you're talking about in the 81st precinct. What I can tell you is that, you know, when I say that PD, the NYPD is the, you know, rigorously quantitative, they still have police officers that are, you know, these are people. They take very seriously their obligations, and they rely as much on, and especially, you know, with a law enforcement background myself, they rely still as much on gut as they do on the data, and it's a synthesis of those. So I think in terms of maybe not forgetting the human element, I think if you forget the human element as a rule, you're going to fail. I think what's necessary, I mean, there's people interpreting this data, and they're bringing in their own biases and understandings of what's going on out there in the city. I think so long as the city continues to remember that it's not just data and it's not just human processes and it's not just people, that it's all of those three working in tandem, then I think, I mean, you're never going to get a cure-all for the kind of issues you're talking about, okay? In any human endeavor, it's just going to be like that. But I think you'll continuously get better, and what data permits you to do is see where you could get better, but there's still a person making decisions at the end of the day.
Rachel, thank you for raising that. Brian in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Mike Flowers. Hi.
Hi. I have a question that maybe you can't answer yet. It's about continuity. The Bloomberg administration is known for its use of data. I'm wondering what the plans are going forward for continuing your office.
You're right. I can't answer that. I mean, there's certain things that I'm trying to do, that we're all trying to do, to keep us sustained. And, you know, the thing is that this is why we have an elected process, right? You know, people come in and they want to go a different direction. That's the will of the electorate. But from our standpoint, my focus has been primarily treating agencies as clients and then embedding the capacity at the agency level. So from the mayor's office level, instead of these, you know, one-off interventions where we go in and say, oh, well, if you just looked at this set and this set and this set, then you could get better, we do that and then, you know, give them the tools to start doing it themselves, as well as incentivizing them to hire the same kind of people that I've hired. In other words, I mean, we're broadening the pyramid base, and the broader the pyramid base is, and it really doesn't matter who sits at City Hall so long as the centralized data coordination role stays.
And I guess the question that he implies is there a backlash now against how data-driven this administration has been? I think we heard a very, you know, warm and sincere articulation of it by the first caller, where data can lead people astray, or where data can just be too cold. And I think in a political sense, Bloomberg himself, the mayor, has a little bit of this reputation now. So you wonder if there's a political backlash, even if what you said is also absolutely true, which is that the data is only as good as the people using it, and you keep refining those interactions to get better and better at it. I guess we won't know until the next mayor comes in.
So, I mean, there may very well be such a backlash. I can't say that I really follow that kind of thing. You know, but I can give you sort of an anecdote, I guess. So at the height of Hurricane Sandy, right, I sat on with the mayor and the deputy mayor for operations in his group, and, you know, a couple of my analysts pretty much through a three-day session, like work straight through with the power out, et cetera. And we came up with basically kind of a sheet that would tell us on, you know, a dynamic basis, you know, the vulnerable public, the number of people that didn't have power, where they were, and how vulnerable they were, basically, you know, cross-tab with the weather. And the mayor kept coming back over and over again to the fact that we had to get these people that were at risk back in their homes or at least secured in someplace safe. So I think the allegation that the mayor takes the data over the people is really a misstatement of what I've seen, at least during my time mm-hmm. here. What it is really is rather we use the data to make sure that we're getting to the right people as quickly as we can. And I think losing that value would be tragic.
One more specific question before we run out of time. One of the information puzzles that we've been talking about since Sandy is not necessarily about property. It's about keeping track of the most vulnerable of the city's residents who might need more help than others during an emergency. So how do you tackle that problem? How do you keep track of, for example, one we've talked about a lot, the elderly during an event like Sandy? Is that a problem that data can solve? And I've heard that keeping track of the elderly for emergency situations is a particular challenge from a data sense.
It's an absolute challenge. It's a challenge from a legal sense as much as it is from a data sense, because much of the data that would tell us where this vulnerable population is protected. And it's statutorily protected very robustly with very few exceptions made for accessing it, right? So, you know, a particularly valuable piece of information that we could use is sort of off the table except to a very small number of actors. So where the data comes into play, and it's not a solution so much as it assists us with our solution, is kind of twofold. One is that we do know at the block level concentrations of at-risk populations, however you want to define them, you know, on receiving benefits or receiving a particularly high level of emergency service emergency services or elderly or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And we also are able very quickly to overlay that with damage zones, you know, for a storm like Sandy. And then from there we can set up, which is what we're doing now in many ways, is something called microgrids, where, you know, in the event there is an outage of some kind of very critical utilities, that we'll be able to stand up these microgrids very quickly in those areas where the most vulnerable people are and get them the most assistance. And so we can take it at the block level at a minimum. And at the block level, that does get us very far.
Michael Flowers, Director of Analytics for Mayor Bloomberg's Office of Policy and Strategic Planning. He's giving a talk at the Guggenheim tonight as part of the museum's Participatory City Program. You want to say anything about that talk before you go?
I'm kind of looking forward to it in the sense that my wife has always loved the Guggenheim. So, it's kind of flattering to be asked in the first place, frankly. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Don't slide down the ramp. And thanks for joining us. This was interesting. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a good day.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we have the Republican candidate in the special U.S. Senate election in New Jersey, which is next Wednesday. That's right, a Wednesday election day. To replace the late Frank Lautenberg, Republican candidate Steve Lonergan next. Stay with us.